This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside, this week of Fates and Phantoms, the anatomy of the ghost story.
So we're continuing on with our countdown to Samhain.
Yeah, we certainly are. Or Halloween, if that's how you prefer to celebrate it. Or, you know, if you want to go super, super Celtic, it's Dyriad in Tuatha. So, the coming of the ancestors.
You know what that means? It's time to hoover the house.
Yes, to prepare for all the ghosts.
What? Sorry, it's just whenever you have people coming round, time to clean up. But remember, you can only have six people in the house at any one time.
It's like, I'm sorry, I don't care if you're dead or not. I can only have six of you. The rest will have to go away until next year.
I don't care if you can't give me COVID. You're not allowed in. The government says so.
Unless you would like to engage in a grouse shoot.
Of course, yeah. Then it's all fine.
I can't believe 30 seconds in, we've already derailed ourselves.
I guess there are just certain things on our mind. Anyway, so today, obviously, we are talking about ghost stories.
Yes, definitely. We've obviously talked about ghosts before and ghost stories before. We're looking very specifically at how to actually write a ghost story because it's a tricky beast. It's a difficult thing to do. And there is a very definite difference between ghost stories that are written down in order to be published or shared or whatever, and ghost stories that are passed around campfires by word of mouth, or, you know, everyone knows about the Grey Lady at school, which was a popular one where I went to school. Or, you know,
everyone's got grey a Grey lady, don't they? So the Grey Lady or the White
or
Lady.
Or a monk, or, you know, a woman in black sometimes. So yeah, the whole ghost story urban legend type thing, there's lots and lots of permutations of it, but they all have certain things in common, and they don't necessarily have to have a point. Those stories, the ones that you pass around from person to person or just to scare the people in the class below you, don't necessarily have to have a beginning, a middle and an end. They just have to have a spooky figure. which is always very amusing. A few years ago, it was 2 years ago now, I went to a Halloween special evening with Andrew Taylor and Phil Rickman, who is one of my favourite writers, and the whole thing was done by candlelight, and we all got together and talked about writing ghost stories. And then, of course, a load of people there weren't actually writers, they were just fans of these two authors, and the number of people who suddenly started volunteering ghostly experiences they'd had. And it was really interesting how so many of these things were like, that they were kind of similar in feel. And a lot of people said they genuinely didn't feel frightened or threatened or anything at the time. It was only afterwards thinking back and realizing how inexplicable it was that gave them a bit of a chill. And, you know, Phil Rickman made the point of, well, that's the thing with ghost stories, is the fact that they're sort of a communal, you almost draw on the same well, and you know almost what someone is going to say before they actually tell you the story, because you're just passing around this urban legend type stuff, and you know, they're the oldest sort of stories in some ways, they're the ones we take in as very young children. So yes, there were a few spooky tales that came out from that, which was interesting, and some which particularly influenced Rickman's work, which I might talk about a bit later. We're looking at talking about how to create actual written ghost stories, which is slightly different.
Yeah, and I think you know, and something I'll mention is the difference. One of the key differences between the spoken ghost story and the written ghost story, and I think one thing you need to consider is atmosphere, and the fact that when a ghost story is told, you have that very human element of someone else telling it to you. And you have their voice. And it also therefore feels more realistic, more trustworthy, because someone is telling it to you rather than you just seeing it written down. which I think sort of brings things closer. And also the other thing to consider is if people are sitting around telling ghost stories, they don't tend to be, you know, out somewhere, you know, in the middle of a shopping mall or something like that. People tend to sort of get themselves ready for ghost stories. So they might light a candle. They might all be huddled, you know, in the dark and stuff like that. And so you have a great sense of atmosphere already being built up. And when told as well, the spoken word is usually slower than the read word, which means that there's more chance to build atmosphere. And it's very interesting, actually, how you can differentiate between the ghost story that you experience and the ghost story that you read. Both can be equally as terrifying, but you have to work a little bit harder and a little bit smarter when it's written down in order to create the same effect.
Definitely. There's lots of things that obviously we'll go into a bit later. But the one point I'd like to make from the start is the fact that there's a big difference between an actual ghost story and a story with ghosts in it. They're two completely different things. The latter is usually urban fantasy or occasionally middle grade fiction, or even romance or mystery, or, you know, a gothic novel. They're not actually ghost stories. A ghost story is a very particular thing, and interestingly enough, a ghost story doesn't have to have any actual ghosts in it.
Yes.
So just to make it confusing, a story with ghosts in it is not the same as a ghost story, which doesn't actually have to have any ghosts in it, really.
You're going to have to break that one down for us a little bit, Jules.
I will do. I think it's something that, you know how we were talking about sex scenes a while back, and you can have a sex scene that has absolutely no sex in it? It's kind of like that with a ghost story. The ghost story is designed to elicit a specific series of feelings, in the same way that a sex scene is, but obviously different feelings with a sex scene. And a ghost story is always about the human and very living main characters, or the characters of that story. It's very rarely ever about the dead. They're kind of the reflective dark mirror. So I'll go into how that comes about a bit later. But the thing with a ghost story is it is often open-ended. Many, many proper ghost stories in the traditional sense end with you not knowing whether there was ever really a ghost.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily have to have a ghost there at all. And sometimes the ghost acts very specifically as a metaphor for a particular part of the human psyche instead. And, you know, again, you don't get the answers at the end. Whereas a story with ghosts in it quite often gives you the answer and is therefore more urban fantasy than an actual ghost story.
Yeah. Okay.
I hope that makes sense.
Yes, I can see you're working.
Right. So, yeah, obviously, sure you're working, particularly if you're talking to Madeline. So you must be able to refer to the text, people. Right.
You better be using the right referencing system.
I think it's, as we go through this and we look at what makes a ghost story and how you would go about writing a ghost story and what sort of things you need to think about, hopefully that entire statement I've just made will make more sense and you will see where I'm coming from.
Yes.
So, what makes a good ghost story? A ghost story is actually fiendishly difficult to write.
Yes.
You have so many things that have to be just so. As Madeline has said, there's atmosphere, there's obviously setting. You need really good structure. I know I go on about structure a lot, but it's really important in a ghost story. You also need to think about theme and what level of scare factor you want. Now, when you're looking at scaring somebody, a ghost story's main purpose isn't necessarily to actually terrify you. That's what horror is for. A ghost story is more to give you that chill of uncertainty and make you question something within yourself. So it's a different feeling.
Yeah, ghost stories in particular survive on tension, suspension, the uncanny, and that chilling factor, which kind of stays with you long into the night.
Definitely. The best ghost stories should leave you feeling that the world is not quite how you thought it was, but you can't entirely put your finger on why. So I know Stephen King in his book Dance Macabre, I think it was talking about, you know, the aspects of fear, and he sort of broke it down into three, which is oversimplifying. And he started with loathing, which is the gross out factor that you get with horror. And it's like, if you cannot really scare somebody, really gross them out because it's almost as good. If you can, accelerate that and actually really scare them. And if you can go further than that, terrify them. Make them too frightened to sleep. This is obviously coming from someone who's made his entire career off this. So, you know, it's reasonable to think about his opinion a little bit.
I do like the idea that he hasn't specifically said just in terms of writing. So it's just this idea of just Stephen King launching himself out of your cupboard in the middle of the night. Just like, ah!
That would actually be quite scary, because you think that him being a writer and, you know, bespectacled, possibly slightly nerdy guy, that he's little and he's not. He's like 6'4". He's a big guy.
Oh my God. That is terrifying. Be wary of Stephen King hiding in your cupboards, guys.
Yeah. I
mean, he could be anywhere.
Considering his writerly output, he's unlikely to just lurk in random cupboards because he's got too much to do, but just in case. But yeah, I completely see his point. Again, you're really not looking for the terrify or the gross out end of the spectrum, although you might bring a little bit of flavour of either of those things into your ghost story. You're really going for the chilling scare in the middle.
Yeah. There also tends to be a great sense of build-up of tension and stuff like that in a ghost story. And building things up, that's how it works especially well in layers, rather than everything all at once. And that is, as Jules said, you really need a very strong sense of structure in order for that to work. Otherwise, the whole thing can fall apart very quickly. It's like a house of cards.
Definitely. It's actually quite difficult to achieve a willing sense of disbelief in general, writing fiction. But achieving a willing sense of disbelief about what is ultimately an uncanny and inexplicable figure who's, you know, by the end of the story is probably not going to have been explained. You lose people. That's why you get so many people saying, oh, you know, I've got no time for ghost stories, etc. Because they've already thoroughly rejected it. So if you can get somebody on board who's one of those, then you know you've got the structure right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Obviously, I've made the point that a ghost story doesn't actually have to have ghosts in it, and that a story with ghosts in it is not a ghost story. It's usually urban fantasy. The other thing to consider is that, yeah, there's lots of stories with a ghost as a main character. I mean, that's not even a particularly original twist anymore, and most of those, believe it or not, are not ghost stories.
No,
some of them are, but most of them are not.
No, it's a little bit like the people who think somehow that if something is set in space it's automatically sci-fi.
It's not. Things cross boundaries. An exception is probably something like The Sixth Sense. The Sixth Sense is a dark fantasy, but I would say that there is a strong ghost story element to it. And, you know, I really hope you guys have already seen The Sixth Sense, or you actually don't care about it, because I'm spoiling the end here. The main character is a ghost, but you don't know for most of the film. The big twist is that he realises he's dead. That's his big realisation. The reason it works as a ghost story is because the entire narrative presupposes that he's alive and is trying to repair a damaged relationship with his wife. Obviously, he worked as a child psychologist and he got something wrong. And here he is with the chance, with a very similar case, to get something right. And obviously you get the jump scares and the chilling moments, and the ghosts are quite inexplicable for most of the film. And it's when you get to the end, you realise that the entire story has treated him as if he's a living main character. He is dealing with his leftover living issues. And it's at the ending is obviously him realising that he's already dead, but he's solved the problem. Yeah. So the fact that it's talking about engaging with mundane issues, a living problem, the fact that he had a difficulty making that leap of faith, that actually makes it a ghost story, even though he's a ghost, and most times when the ghost is the main character, it's not actually a ghost story.
No, exactly. The other thing about sort of the ghost stories is it's this idea of being haunted. And that's where it really comes into it. This idea of being haunted by something. And that's also why sometimes you can have ghost stories which don't actually involve ghosts, because sometimes it's just memories.
Yeah, definitely.
Or the sense of something past. And that definitely happens in The Sixth Sense. You have that sense of the past looming constantly. And there are a lot of ghosts in The Sixth Sense as well, definitely. But it is that very, it's the human aspect as well of kind of the past holding on as well that really brings it all together, I think, anyway.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So yeah, The Sixth Sense, kind of a mixture of the two kind of things. And obviously you see other ghost stories that are of films, and some of them are actually horror parading behind a ghost mask. They're not technically ghost stories, you know, if we're being strict to the letter here. I think the main thing with a ghost story is the fact that the external supernatural mystery, the ghost component, is actually a mirror for the internal struggle of the main character. And the main character is usually living and very human and is struggling with something quite mundane, but something that they cannot quite get over. I have to admit, I kind of jumped back and forth a little bit with I Belong to the Earth. It was intended to be a ghost story, and by the end it's kind of veered a little bit into urban fantasy.
Yeah.
And obviously the rest of the series completely goes into urban fantasy. I abandon the ghost story and just go completely in that direction, even though there's ghosts and things. But the whole idea of this mirroring, to use my own work as an example, is the fact that the main character, Emlyn, really has a difficulty with the fact that her life is not as it was before. Everything's changed. Everything's been upended on her. And she has this skill she doesn't want, and she's lost a number of skills that she did actually want to hold on to. And she's at odds with her family. And the entire thing is about a struggle between people who are having difficulty connecting with each other, which is nicely echoed by the ghost story, where it's all about people who are connecting with each other in the wrong way and causing lots of problems centuries down the line.
Yeah. And obviously also with Emmeline, she's haunted by her mother. But her mother is, even if her mother is a ghost within the story, she's really not actually there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's I've never explained that, and obviously I won't explain it now, but all you ever get is something that could technically be very strong sense memory. So a hint of shampoo, or the fact that, you know, a certain book appears at a certain page kind of thing. All things which could have plausible explanations that are clearly outside the other supernatural confines of the story. So you don't know how much of it is a case of it's coming back to Em because she's remembering things and she's allowing herself to actually feel and grieve.
Yeah, but in that way, we get that very haunted element. But once again, no guarantee that that's actually a ghost in any shape or form. But it's a ghost in terms of the fact it's haunting her, helpfully in some cases. But she's very haunted by what's happened. And that lies at the heart of kind of what's stopping her in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, that is, I think for me, that is probably one of the big clarifying things as to whether something's a ghost story or not. Do the supernatural elements act as a dark mirror for the mundane struggles?
Yeah, absolutely.
As Madeline said, obviously ghost stories are a study in tension and payoff. And if you stack everything right, then the payoff is, the payoff is usually a good one in the sense of it's satisfying. But at the same time, I've read quite a few ghost stories where the ending is right and it's perfect for that story, but it leaves you feeling not entirely satisfied. It leaves you feeling slightly disquieted. So if you think of a piece of music that's really quite haunting in a minor key, and instead of the musician resolving it on the final bar, instead they leave it sort of slightly open. Perhaps they resolve it on one of the notes of the chord that isn't actually the main note of the chord, if you see what I mean, the bass note. And that sort of sense of disquiet just follows you from the song.
Yes, absolutely.
So a bit like that. And ghosts are also, as I've said before, used kind of as metaphors, as personifications of the less tangible aspects of the main character. So I've got a list here. I've got depression, the past memory issues, repressed fears. Yeah. Repressed desires is a big one.
Well, yeah, we'll give some examples in a second. But the turn of the screw just immediately rears its spooky little head.
Yeah, The Turn of the Screw is a good example. That's Henry James, if people want to find the story and read it. I can't say I like it, but I do think it's a good example. And it's kind of a riff off Jane Eyre and Rebecca and various other things, where you have a governess who sort of falls for her employer and then starts imagining that his children... I mean, she's left isolated and alone a lot, and isolation for the main character is a big thing in a ghost story.
Yes.
She's left with these two children who seem to be adorable and then gradually do more and more sinister things. Or do they? Because the governess is quite clearly not an entirely reliable narrator.
No.
And the fact that there was another governess before who apparently ended up in like a sanitarium based on the time frame and the, when this was actually set. And it's you wonder whether the governess is right and her employer has actually been giving her some encouragement, and she's been brought in as a sort of proto-mother and will eventually marry him, which is what she's hoping for. And she's kind of repressing all this sort of sexual desire for him, and at the same time kind of frightened of his children, perhaps frightened of the representation of the fact that he obviously loved someone else and fathered children on them.
No, actually, because they're not his children.
Are they?
No, they're actually his. He adopted them because they're his niece and nephew.
Oh, right. Okay. I mean, to be fair, I haven't read the book for a while, and the last thing I saw was an adaptation which had them as actually his children, so I might be going off that.
No, that's fair enough. I do think you're still right, because there is this sense of the fact he does kind of not lead her on as such, but what's very interesting to me is the fact that she meets him once.
Yes.
She meets him once right at the beginning, and he's never seen again, but she kind of starts to fixate on him.
Yeah, big time.
And then there's this underlining thing where she starts to feel threatened by this other man who's there, who was apparently a very close companion to the Lord, or whatever he is, the master of the house, who she's fallen in love with. And, you know, he kind of let this guy get away with whatever he wanted. And you start to get a sense that maybe the whole thing is that this previous governess, who has died, who she's, you know, suspicious of, and this previous guy, who is apparently also dead, are competition, and she sees them as competition, and she sees them getting in the way of her ability to sort of be a mother, to this guy's difficulty being a father. She's trying to fill this role, and then she kind of starts to imagine these threats in terms of having this perfect record. And it's very interesting, because on the one side you can read it that this is a ghost story, and that she's not lost her mind. She's, you know, she's actually battling against something evil that no one else can help her with. Or on the other side, it isn't a ghost story. And she's being driven crazy by something or someone, or there's something already going on. And it's quite a faceted ghost story, and it is quite terrifying, actually.
Definitely. And it does the classic ghost story thing of you get to the end and you still don't know whether there are any ghosts or not.
No.
I mean, you could absolutely argue that there were, and you could absolutely argue that there weren't. And it leaves you with that sort of unresolved note at the end, that feeling of being quite disquieted. In that respect, the sort of the ghostly or supernatural, in this respect, sort of devilry type influences kind of represent her own repressed desires in a lot of ways, and her isolation.
Yes, always isolation. Isolation seems to be a key thing when it comes to...
Yes. And it doesn't have to be someone who's completely on their own all the time. It can be emotional isolation as well.
Yeah.
So, and obviously a big thing is ghost stories can teach us about dealing with grief. And, you know, they can literally be a personification of dealing with grief.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, so there we go. The many ways that you can approach a ghost story, and how it doesn't actually have to have real ghosts as part of it for it to be an actual ghost story.
No, and that's I think that's the strange thing about them, is the fact that a ghost story is not necessarily a moralizing story, but it kind of teaches you what's important about being alive if it goes in a happy direction. If it's a ghost story that goes in an unhappy direction, then the main character doesn't seem to learn this lesson. And everything ends in disaster. And you still get that unresolved note at the end, but with a lot more sort of dissatisfaction.
It sort of teaches the reader, doesn't it?
Yeah. It teaches the reader. Okay, so how to write a ghost story? Well, it's one of those things where, obviously I've said before, I don't like prescriptive writing advice, but I will say that there are a few things that you need to bear in mind when you're writing a ghost story. And I honestly wouldn't hold myself up as an expert here, because let's be honest, I tried to write a ghost story for my first novel and it swerved into urban fantasy. So, you know, I'm copying to that right now. Obviously, I've written short story ghost stories since then. It's made me look at the structure, because the structure of a ghost story is an interesting thing to actually learn how to do, and it's useful for other things as well. But it's very noticeable that a lot of newbie writers are drawn to ghost stories first off. I know lots of people who started off with a novel that was a ghost story, and that seemed to be their go-to point. I did a self-editing course, and there were, I think, 12 of us on the course, and fully half of us had written ghost stories.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. There is something to be said, I think, probably because everybody knows at least one ghost story, even if you don't know it that well. Everyone knows at least one.
Definitely. And that's what we were talking about at the beginning. So similar to folklore, but so much more accessible. They're the stories that we take in before we're even old enough to be aware that we're hearing stories. Yeah. And they stay with us, and we develop them as we get older. And then we get to the macabre age of being teenagers, and we really get to town on them and embroider them.
Yeah, I do think that they are just, it's one of these supplements of youth, isn't it? The ghost story. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, if you have a grandmother like mine, or both my grandmothers, in fact, will be different ghost stories, then you absolutely definitely got a decent dose of it. And that's before I even got taken out to Ireland and met all my great aunts and great uncles, who all had their own slew of ghost stories.
Yeah, one day we're just going to have an episode which is you just recounting all these ghost stories.
So obviously that's where my personal fascination came from. But ghost stories tell us about humanity, and they are effectively some of the hardest things to write, because the structure is so very particular. So even if you don't have actual ghosts, you need a certain number of story beats. I've counted this out. I'll do a blog post because it's too much for this episode, but I counted out something like 48 particular story beats that you don't have to hit every single one of them, but you need to hit about half a dozen, six to eight of them, put it that way. Because let's assume your audience knows they want to read a ghost story, even if they don't know that they like ghost stories, as it were. And if you do not hit about eight of those beats, then they're going to be dissatisfied with what you've written. And there's a potential, there's sort of like half a dozen that you really should have hit every time. And then there's a few more that you can add in. But overall, there's something like 48 beats that turn up reliably in ghost stories that are worth knowing about. I'm not, as I said, going to go into all of them, because we just don't have time for that. I will make the point of saying that this is not the same as writing by numbers. So this isn't a case of you go there, then you go there, then you do this. This is not turning out formulaic James Patterson type stuff that is just popcorn fiction. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with popcorn fiction. Sometimes all someone wants is a bag of popcorn. So it's not like that. There's definitely scope for originality and turning things on their heads a bit and changing things around and doing different and interesting things with structure. Absolutely. But you must do a certain number of these things.
Otherwise it just won't feel like a ghost story.
It won't read like one. And the audience who've gone, hoo-hoo, that looks like my sort of thing, is just going to be really disappointed.
Okay. All right. So, do you want to give us a few examples? Bearing in mind, we don't have time for all of them, but what do you think are some of the most important ones?
Okay, well, a big one for me, and actually I think probably for everyone who reads ghost stories, is setting. setting is hugely important. If I say ghost story, there's a good chance that one of the first things you're going to think of is a haunted house. There's a reason for that. It's the setting. It's the... It's kind of like fairyland in the sense of there is a place where this stuff can happen.
Absolutely.
And having a place that you can go to and then retreat from is what makes these a comfortable armchair alternative to genuine horror in your actual life.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, here, this is the interesting part when you kind of look at the history of the ghost stories and how it sort of bumps in with other genres, including the gothic. Pathetic fallacy plays a large part in ghost stories, because pathetic fallacy in some ways is part of that setting. It's part of the whole atmosphere that you are trying to create. So trying to write a ghost story in a house which looks incredibly friendly and, you know, just this very sort of upbeat thing, that's not impossible. You know, I have seen people who have actually managed to create, you know, some very strong ghost stories, even in a relatively modern setting. I mean, Stephen King has done it on a few occasions. But there is something to be said about particularly old houses or old spots where people naturally kind of get a little bit frightened. I mean, everyone has been to an old building at one point, and even if you've thought it's amazingly beautiful, there's this sense of... I don't know how to say this without sounding like a massive hippie, but there's this sense of layers of time that exists over it, something larger and bigger than you, and that makes you feel a little bit uncertain. And if all the lights are off and the wind is blowing through and it feels cold and it's dark, then it's the perfect... I tell you what... Sorry, a small tangent, but this is one of my favourite things. I got a book called The Other Crowd, or something like that. And it was written by a famous Shanachy from Ireland, who literally just transposed how he would tell these stories. And he had this amazing tale right at the beginning, where he would say that he would go from place to place in Ireland... and ask people about kind of ghost stories and fairy stories and things like that. And he would go to the pub, which is where he would meet all these people. And during the daylight hours, all of them sort of laughed. They laughed at him. They didn't have anything to say. They said, oh, you know, there's nothing to it. And then when darkness fell, and when things got a little bit quieter and they all huddled at the bar, one by one they'd all go, but I do have a story for you. And I love that so much, which is just, the sun goes down, they're like, ha ha, we don't believe this, but don't go up that hill at night.
Yeah, and this is the thing, even if you're looking at this is one of the ones that Phil Rickman told me. Not me personally, but the entire room, the group of us that all got together because we thought Halloween was a great time to talk about ghost stories. And he's actually written a little novella as part of his Merrily Watkins series called The House of Susan Lullum. And I think it was the only one that I got a genuine sort of bit of a chill off that story. And it turns out that the main thrust of that story is actually true. As in, a couple moved into an old-ish house, you know, one of those real character-type places. And things just started to go wrong. There were electrical problems, there were noises in the night. And then one of the, I think it was the young wife, said that, you know, she'd seen somebody about the house. And it got so bad and they were so unsettled that they called in the local deliverance minister. Deliverance ministry isn't quite the same as being an exorcist. Exorcism is the absolute last step, and you actually need something in writing from the seniors of the church in order to do anything like that in Anglican ministry, for very good reasons, which I won't go into right now. Perhaps we'll do something on exorcism another time. Anyway, he said what happened was the two of them got together a group of six neighbours and this priest, and they were just going to say a requiem mass. And the whole point of a requiem mass is just to leave everybody feeling calm and relaxed about it, and to put anything that might be sort of still loitering sort of to sleep, you know, to add a note of closure. Yeah. So instead of this disquieting note where you've ended on a slightly wrong note, on the wrong chord, which can happen in life as well, this is closing the song, if you like. So they had the couple, six neighbours, and the priest. So that was nine people. And they were saying the Requiem Mass, and there was a weird draft through the room, even though all the windows were closed and the door was closed, and the curtains were rustling, and then a glass or something rattled on the nightstand. And then as they got midway through to the part where they were all about to celebrate the Eucharist, the priest looked round and realised that there was a tenth person in the room. And it was someone who, it was an old lady who was leaning heavily on her stick because she only had one leg. And they went all the way through. And then at the end, everyone was really, really quiet. And it was back to being a normal number of nine people in the room. And it was only later when they'd all gone down the pub, people saying, you know, how many people did you count in there? It's like, oh, nine, and then 10, and then nine again. And about five different people said, yeah, we actually saw her. And two of them were neighbours who'd actually known this old lady who had just one leg. And it's the subtlety of it. Because that sounds, you know, if you're listening to this now in the light or whatever, that sounds a bit sort of like that's quite funny. But can you imagine being in that situation and you look around and nothing has really changed except that you can now see something that you couldn't see before?
Yeah. It's amazing as well, though, because if that was just sort of written as a kind of a general story, most people would be like, well, that's not actually a very good story. But as a kind of a snapshot, when it's being told to you, you get that sense that you were there, and it gives you that tingling sense of something that shouldn't have been seen has been seen, and I'm not comfortable with it.
Yeah. So, again, setting is important. And, you know, setting is one of the main points where ghost stories and folk horror do cross over. But we'll look at folk horror in a future episode. We've got that all planned. And we're just looking at ghosts here. So it can be anything. It can be a remote Welsh valley. It can be an old barn that's been left derelict and then recently converted. And doesn't it look like the perfect starter home for a young couple of thing?
Perfect place to move away from the city and take a new fresh start with your two kids after a tragedy.
Yeah. It can be a house with a known history. It can be like the ancient ram in Wootton, which is like just down the road from where I work, where there's been any number of mysterious deaths. So, yeah, the setting is important, and capturing the setting. I think if you can capture the setting, then you've halfway captured your reader.
Absolutely. Particularly if it's a kind of a setting that people can picture perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. Other things you might want to think about. Obviously, you have an inciting incident, but it's a bit of a particular one with a ghost story, if you're writing one, that is. It needs to be carefully handled. There needs to be a hint of the uncanny, but you mustn't telegraph to your reader exactly what's going on. In fact, you might have an inciting incident where they think, oh, something mundane's happening. And it's only later when they look back they realise how absolutely weird that was. And it's a delicate balancing act because your main character must not necessarily know what's going on.
And this is actually a really good difference between the kind of inciting incident that you'd have in a written book and the kind of thing that you'd see in a film. I want to use The Woman in Black as an example here, just to really illustrate this. In the, I say recent, but in the Woman in Black movie with Daniel Radcliffe, they start off by showing these children committing suicide. Or jumping from a window, being compelled to jump from a window. And that sort of acts, it's not actually the inciting incident, but it's sort of the inciting incident for the audience that sort of pulls them on the journey. Whereas in The Woman in Black, the inciting incident for the character, Kipps, comes when Mrs. Drablow, has died, and he's sort of asked to go out to this backward town in the middle of nowhere. And it's slow going, but I really like it because there's this sort of, it starts off relatively, okay, well, this is a slightly strange assignment. You know, she's in the middle of nowhere, but someone has to go, and fine. And it just sort of gets a bit weirder and weirder. Like, okay, so there's, it is a little bit of a strange place. There's this, that, and the other, and you get this creeping feeling. And there are no ghosts, but there's this sense of secrecy where we as the reader kind of know, all right, immediately we know there's going to be some spooky stuff, which is kind of makes it almost funny because we're like, obviously there's something going on here. But Kipps is just this oblivious businessman who's just going about his day, getting enrolled in something that is just getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, yeah, it's a delicate balancing act. You cannot absolutely boldly go, oh, here we are, this is a house, there's obviously something haunted about it, there's a ghost problem. Or if you're going to do that, then it needs to be a careful untangling of exactly what the ghost is.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it depends whether your main character is clued up or an unbeliever or someone who's just, you know, doesn't really see these things at all and is being forced to see them without, you know, without context kind of thing. Again, that's something I had part of M's story is the fact that she can actually see ghosts for I Belong to the Earth. And it's got stronger. It's got worse. This is all tied up with very complicated feelings about her mother's death and the fact that she's had to relocate. And she does not want this on top of everything else. So she's kind of trying to be willfully ignorant and failing at it utterly.
If I ignore it enough, it'll go away.
It's kind of like, I just have to survive another year in this house and then I'm out of here kind of thing. I want to run away from all of my problems.
Because there are only ghosts in that house, not everywhere else as well.
Yeah. Well, she's 17, you know? We all have flawed logic at 17 at some points.
Agreed.
Okay, the other thing, you might want an unbeliever character, and it's useful. I mean, you cannot... Or rather, there's not going to be much tension if you have a... Let's say you've got your haunted house, you've got your inciting incident, and you set it up carefully, and then everybody goes into that house going, oh, gee, I hope there are ghosts here. We all believe in ghosts. We love ghosts. We love ghost posse. There's no tension there. So if you've got a main character who either comes in with the sort of, like, I've always been able to see ghosts, and I'm in a position, this is not a good place to be... Or you've got a main character who's kind of like being forced to admit that there is something uncanny going on. You really need another character to make them constantly doubt their own sanity by saying, what are you talking about? This is bollocks.
And the other thing is that the character who makes them doubt their own sanity, they needn't actually be a true non-believer. It could be just someone who's unwilling to talk about it. Or who dismisses things. Again, the woman in black is a great example where no one actually wants to talk about the woman. So the moment anything's kind of raised, they all sort of go quiet and they just stop talking about it and they change the subject. Which in some ways just makes, you know, Kipps, who considers himself to be this very rational person, has just suddenly found he's questioning everything. He's questioning his own logic because he doesn't know whether he can trust himself.
Yeah, absolutely. Which sort of leads us on to another beat that you probably do want to hit, and that is where your main character is being forced to confront the idea that the world is perhaps not as they thought it was, and that there is more here than meets the eye. There's something uncanny going on. And you may want them to be doubting their own senses, their own sanity, or at times their own memory of events. They might be in a state where they cannot trust their own memory or anybody else's memory of things either.
It's not a great state to be in, to be honest.
No, well, it's great for the story, but not for the really person. Person this is all part of the isolation thing as well. So, yes, you can have someone who's surrounded by people. Again, Em's got her sisters and, you know, her father's very distant, but there are other people who are reaching out to her, and she's emotionally isolating, and she's emotionally isolating herself because she doesn't want to be hurt anymore.
Yeah.
But again, this all feeds into the whole, I'm not sure I can believe my own senses, and there's something weird going on with my sisters. Yes.
And she's very isolated as well. That's the thing, is that she's in a house. There's, you know, there's four of them all in the house together. she's got, there are people in town, in fact in some ways that there's a little bit too much attention on them in town. They're being watched constantly, you know, everybody knows who they are. There's this quite claustrophobic feel. And then she's got that, you know, that interesting new boy who's appeared from nowhere, and the you know, the suspiciously knowledgeable old woman who, does she mean well, does she not, who knows. You know, you have all these characters, and yet the whole point is that M is incredibly isolated from it all, because first of all she has this stutter which makes it hard for her to communicate with people, because a lot of people don't give her the time to get her words out.
Yeah.
And she kind of stops speaking because she's embarrassed. And she doesn't kind of want to risk hurting herself. And then the other thing is that she's going through all of this on her own. There's no one else kind of who she thinks really understands what she's going through. So you get that great sense of isolation. And I say great sense of isolation. You know what I mean.
yeah.
Throughout. And it's just, it's very, very well done in that sense. And obviously the setting is perfect. There's something inherently rather creepy about big wide moors, you know, the wind blowing.
Yeah, yeah, everything is, it's layers and layers of isolation, yeah. Isn't it? You've got all the characters who are all isolating in their own way or going off with the wrong people.
Yes, going off with the wrong people is definitely a reoccurring theme.
yeah, so in a previous episode when we were talking about romance structure, I called one point the point of ritual death, which is actually a romance term, mm-hmm. believe it or not. But in a ghost story, this is not the point where you necessarily would have someone die, although you absolutely mm-hmm. could do. This is the point where the curtain between the canny and the uncanny swings to one side and you get a really good glimpse of something.
Ah, yes.
So it's a turning point of the story. You have your midpoint where your main character has a bit of a success. Everything then starts to go downhill from there. You hit the point of ritual death. The curtain has swung to one side and now everything is in free fall again.
Free fall is not necessarily a great place to be. For some odd reason.
Certainly not if... Well, certainly not if you have no parachute, or if reality is not the reality you thought it was.
Yes.
But that... I mean, usually that is one of the main creepy moments of a story. That's usually one of the main, oh my god, moments.
Is that the technical term?
Yeah, oh my god, nothing is what I thought it was. And I guess everything kind of progresses from here. So however the story ends, whether it's happy or sad, it will depend on how your main character processes that point of ritual death moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, don't take these terms literally.
No, don't actually have a ritual.
Could.
I mean, you can do, but that's, ritual death is more of a folk horror thing, really. So, you know, because I'm banging on about my own book today, M's point of ritual death moment in the ghost story terms is when she suddenly realises that her youngest sister has been affected by the pattern all along. And it doesn't seem like a huge thing, but it's such a sideswipe of the curtain that she can suddenly see how everything has fit together, and that it's almost an impossible task to bring that to a close.
Yeah, absolutely. It is quite a powerful moment as well. And I think that's the thing, is that you hear the words ritual death and you assume it's got to be this huge sweeping, you know, and it's not. It's a kind of the small pin that sort of pulls everything together towards the end, doesn't it?
Yeah, it can be quite subtle, but it is the moment when your main character suddenly realizes that, you know, this is almost impossible. I've heard it also described as the moment of greatest despair,
yes,
as well, and perhaps that fits slightly better here.
Yeah,
so other things. There is some part of the main character who has a connection with the supernatural. So there's either an investment in the ghost being real, or a really big investment in the ghost not being real.
And obviously the way that you approach that is going to make it swing in two different ways. It's, sorry, it just makes me think, it's one of the most frustrating things when you've just got a character saying, there's a ghost here. And there's always that naysayer who's like, no, there isn't. And then they always cause more trouble.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. I think a good example here is The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters, which I've talked about before. And even though you cannot 100% be sure there is actually a ghost at the end of that book, and it's a big book with a big slow burn setup, mm-hmm. you cannot be sure that there is a genuine little stranger. And it's so well done. I think it's one of the most effective ghost stories I've ever read, despite the fact that you still get to the end thinking, well, okay, I personally think there's a ghost, but I couldn't refer anyone to the text and say there's something there. And one of the most chilling things is the main character is obviously very acquisitive about getting his hands on the House Hundreds. He comes from a slightly lower, you know, upper working class family. He's had a good education, but he's a doctor and he always has to use the tradesman's entrance. And this family, I mean, this is during the time when the gentry and the aristocracy were falling into decline in Britain. It was after the First World War. And he's desperate to move up a class. He's a, you know, he's a bit of a snob and a social climber internally. And he's always wanted to get his hands on that house. And to the point where he'll marry a woman that, you know, he doesn't really love. He'll tell himself he loves her and he's obsessed with her. And he certainly is obsessed in order to get his hands on it. And it's noticeable how something bad befalls every member of that house one by one. And it's kind of put down to, oh, it's an accident. And other people are going, it's the ghost, it's the ghost. Meanwhile, nobody's looking at this doctor. No one is looking at Dr. Faraday, who is kind of present for all of these incidents bar one.
Isn't that amazing how that happens sometimes?
But the thing was, I mean, he could not probably, to the point where you get to the end and you don't know whether or not he kind of almost allows himself a moment of self-knowledge and then pulls back from it because it's too horrible, because what if it is him? And you're kind of left with this feeling that, you know, he's the only person who then goes back to Hundreds after that, and he'll sweep the leaves away, and he has a set of keys which he never returned, so he kind of owns it by default at the end, even though it's not his. He acts as though it's his, but he never sees anything supernatural there. And then there's this moment where he catches a glimpse of his reflection in the mirror, startles, thinking it's the ghost, and realizes it's him. And you're left with this, oh my god, was he the malevolent presence at Hundreds the entire time?
That's actually quite a good, that's very spooky.
It is really, really creepy. It's such a good book.
I like that.
But obviously his huge investment was, no, there is no ghost, but also, yes, there is a ghost, because it keeps removing people from the line of succession, and then it'll go to the woman. If I marry the woman, then I'll finally own the damn house. So very conflicted about what he wants there.
That's brilliant. That's very scary.
This one's kind of a bugbear for me, but the supernatural has its own logic.
Yeah.
So yes, you may never fully explain it, and if you're writing a ghost story, you probably won't. But the reader should feel that whoever is telling the ghost story, not the narrator, but the writer, knows what's going on. You can't have random spooky shit happening for no reason. It has to follow a particular brand of logic, even if that logic does not resemble our Earth logic.
Like, they did a checklist of going, well, that's creepy, let's just add that in. That you can't do that. That's not how it works. There has to be a reason. There has to be a line of logic. And as Jill says, it doesn't need to be human logic. It doesn't need to be earthly logic. But it does need to make sense. And just adding something because it happens to be a little bit creepier doesn't actually add to the story. Ultimately, you might have a quick sort of jump scare. But if you might kind of creep someone out a little bit. But if it doesn't tie into what the whole story is about, then it starts to just feel a bit random and cheap and disappointing.
It doesn't make any sense. Dolls are epically creepy. I think we can all agree on that. And that's the thing. It is kind of cheating if you don't have any kind of internal logic, something that's internally consistent to the narrative. It was the same problem I had with Laura Purcell's The Silent Companions. Obviously, this is opinion. And she, Laura Purcell's won any number of awards for her reading group fiction type books. It irks me a little bit that you've got someone who's writing more on the literary spectrum, who's clearly borrowed from genre fiction, and then decided they can just throw the rules out the window and not pay any respect to the genre fiction canon. So that's a tiny, tiny bugbear compared to The Silent Companions, where basically a pregnant widow is sent to her husband's estate, which he's always kept her from, and she breaks into a tower room, which has been locked up for reasons, and discovers what are called silent companions, which are basically paintings, life-size, but, you know, cutouts on wood, painted to look like real-life people. And she's like, oh, they're a bit creepy, let's shut the tower back up again. And then they're randomly moving around the house, apparently. She just finds them in the hall and, you know, standing over her bed kind of thing. That's kind of creepy. And then it kind of loses its appeal because she finds a diary that goes back to when these silent companions are supposedly created. And what has happened makes no sense at all. In fact, it goes against any sort of internal logic for the story. So what I was left with was, okay, slightly disturbed woman is chased around her house by paper dolls. And I'm like, this story is not working for me. Loads of people said they loved it and found it really, really creepy. I'm guessing they were reading it just as it was, taking it on face value and not thinking, hang on a second.
Yeah.
This will not satisfy the true ghost story connoisseur.
No.
Put it that way. So yes, the supernatural has its own logic. Remember that.
Yes, it does.
And my final point, something you might want to consider out of the many, many beats that you can choose from. The best ghost stories end on a note of question. So as I was talking about with my metaphor with music earlier, where you don't resolve quite on the same note that you started on.
Yeah.
You resolve on a sister note. It's like that. There's a bittersweet element. So if the main character succeeds, perhaps not everything falls out exactly as they want it to.
No.
Some things remain a mystery and will stay that way.
Yeah. And I think actually that mystery element at the end is one of the key factors of the ghost story. And again, it makes me think of The Woman in Black, where the whole thing, you know, at the end of the book, there is almost this final note, which they then address in the play. And at the end of the book, what happens is that Kipps, sorry for spoilers guys, but Kipps leaves, he manages to escape, and he goes back to his normal life, and everything sort of goes normal, but the Woman in Black hunts him down, essentially, and she kills his wife and child. And then that's it, and he sort of leaves, but he has to write down the story, and then there's this sense, it is done. And that's kind of where it ends, that he just had to get it down on paper, but he was never going to show anybody. But there was still that sense of, okay, but someone might find it one day. But the play, the way the play ends is just terrific. Because the premise of the play is that it's very metafictional. The character of Kipps has come to an actor to help him tell this story because he wants to tell his family so that they understand what happened to him. And throughout, you know, they'll jump in and out of the story where they'll suddenly break and they'll be the actor and Mr. Kipps again. And then right at the end, you have the story concludes and with it is done. And then they break and it's just the actor and Mr. Kipps, and they shake hands. And finally, the actor, you know, the actor just goes, but, you know, you're surprised. She was fantastic. You know, the woman you hired in to play her, that she was just absolutely brilliant. And the final thing is Mr. Kipps staring in vague horror and just going, but I didn't see a woman in black. And then it ends, and you suddenly realise, oh my god, the woman who was walking around the whole time, who was walking among us, isn't actually an actress. She's the actual woman. And they just leave it there. It's terrifying.
They did something different with the film, in the sense of you start it with Kipps actually having already lost a child.
Yeah, and he's lost his wife as well, hasn't he?
And his wife as well. Yeah. And then at the end, they've changed it in the sense of Kipps dies, but you feel that the woman in black has kind of like come to some sort of accord with him.
Yeah.
And either maybe she's acted out of spite, but maybe she's acted out of kindness to reunite him with his family.
Yeah. And you see him and his little boy sort of walking away together.
Yeah. I have to say, it didn't entirely work for me.
No, but it was quite interesting.
Yeah, so they had a good try. So yeah, your job as a writer of ghostly fiction is to make the reader feel that they've had a glimpse at the dark behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And you're not showing everything, you are not explaining everything. All you're doing is sweeping it aside for one moment and casting a seed of doubt and leaving them with that seed.
Yeah. He's just like, here, hold this. Why, where have you gone? You just run away. That's essentially what we're doing.
Yeah, basically. So, you know, to sum up that part of the podcast, basically, writing ghost stories is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy. It's not as simple as, oh, this is a bit spooky. Or, you know, here's a ghost. That's a story with a ghost in it. That's not a ghost story.
Yeah. And it's okay if you do want to write that, but...
Absolutely.
If you're trying to write a ghost story, there's lots of things that you do need to consider.
Yeah. Right, so let's finish off with our favourite ghost stories, which did actually get it right.
Well, I've said it a few times. I am going to have to put forward The Woman in Black again, just because it was one of these ghost stories that has... continuously absolutely terrified me. The first time I encountered it, I did see the play, and I'm traumatized is probably the closest word I'll come to it. I was potentially a little bit too young to go and see it. It had such a profound effect on me. I was so scared for so many years. It's a really scary play.
Yeah, for me, obviously, I rate the Little Stranger by Sarah Waters, which, again, is it a ghost story? I mean, I feel it's a ghost story, but I can't point to an absolute ghost in it.
Yeah.
Which is, it oddly makes it scarier or more unsettling, I think. I would also point to Phil Rickman's Merrily Watkins series, and... he draws on ghost story mythos a lot. I mean, they're technically crime novels. You'll find them shelved under crime.
Mm-hmm.
But when he was talking about them, when I went to this talk a couple of years ago, he said, actually, I write ghost stories. He said, they are ghost stories. Yes, it's about this woman, this female priest who becomes a diocesan exorcist or a deliverance minister. And there's weird stuff going on. And he draws on folk horror a lot as well.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, they're basically ghost stories.
Nothing wrong with that. Got to admit, the Turn of the Screw, I've always been rather fond of the Turn of the Screw. It just ticks lots of boxes for me, because you do have that real sense of tension and the psychology going in, and there's just so many ways that you can read it as a story as well.
Yeah, definitely. And there's things like The Signalman by... Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously people have written ghost stories since the 1800s,
yes.
But some of the ones that really seem to work are the ones by M.R. James and, you know, Dickens, The Signalman.
Mm-hmm.
Again, The Signalman, is it a ghost, isn't it? Don't really know.
No one knows.
You come away not really knowing at the end of the story. And I think that's what... that kind of is what makes it work, is that sense of not knowing.
Yeah.
I have to say, I reread some M.R. James, and I was kind of like, you know, O Whistle and I'll Come to Thee.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, perhaps I've got hardened to the genre, but I was expecting to be chilled. And at the end, I was kind of like, oh, you know, punctured kind of thing.
Yeah, but I'm going to have to point out that you are not reliable when it comes to Scarometer. I draw back again to that one time you were writing a story. And I said, God, that last chapter was scary. And you went, oh, was it? It wasn't really that scary. It wasn't meant to be scary. And I was like, Jules, something is crawling out of the well. It's scary. So I don't trust you whenever you say it's not that scary. I am deeply suspicious.
I don't know. I mean, it's like I took shamelessly borrowed from Wuthering Heights the ghost story aspect of Wuthering Heights, at least, for I Belong to the Earth, because, you know, in part, I Belong to the Earth is a homage to Wuthering Heights, and it's about me sorting out some complicated feelings about that book.
Yes.
The bit that I thought was creepiest was when she's spending the first night there and there's something tapping at the window.
Yes, that was one of the scariest bits. The other really scary bit for me, other than the tapping at the window, was when she started singing about Long Lambkin.
Which is funny, really, because there's no ghosts in that scene at all.
I know, there's no ghosts in it, but you get that sudden sense of this presence on the moors. And I was like, nope, that's a no from me.
There's the other bit that I think where I came closest to actually freaking myself out, and I didn't come that close, but I came closer than I thought I could, was when she's gone downstairs to get a glass of water and she thinks Amy's gone outside, so she follows her and puts her hand out to stop this little blonde girl, and the blonde girl turns around and she has no eyes.
Yes, that's...
because she's a revenant, she's not actually her sister. And manages to get back into the kitchen, shuts the door, and is kind of leaning on the sink, staring in fear out the window in case that creature's still out there, and then turns sideways and realises there's a man standing next to her. I'm so mean there. I'm basically going, ah, it's all over, it's all over, you can relax, your guard can go down. It's a ghost!
That first book did scare me. It's got to be said. I Belong to the Earth. I mean, to be honest, I've been freaked out by several bits, but the first book really chilled me in quite a few places. It was very well done. I think you did manage to tick those ghost story boxes quite well.
Right up into the end, where I kind of went, and oh look, there's urban fantasy over there. Let's go that way. I don't know, it has a very different feel to the rest of the series, I think.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't go back and change that, because that was obviously something I wanted to do, but
I don't think you need to
it could stand on its own as a ghost story, and you need never read the rest of the series.
Yeah,
and you just have a ghost story.
Yeah, you could. So there you go. So there we are, our favorite ghost stories. And on that note, we are actually coming towards the end of the episode.
We certainly are.
Before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, both Jules and I are going to be recommending the same thing. So we watched Enola Holmes, both of
us. We did.
Not together, I should add, but we did. Not together. We watched it.
Madeline sent me a message saying, I've just seen it. I was thinking, well, damn, because I'm not going to get Alan to watch that anytime soon. And he suggested it for the other night. I was like, yeah, okay, great. We'll totally watch that. Great.
And I think, despite the fact that both of us were umming and ahhing about Henry Cavill as Sherlock Holmes, because I don't think either of us were entirely convinced by him as Sherlock Holmes, we both really enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely.
It was good fun. It was actually really, really good. It's a nice little story. It approaches things in a unique way. I think one of my favourite bits was just at one point Sherlock is confronted about the fact he's not interested in politics.
Yes.
And I thought that actually, that was actually a really strong moment. That was very good.
Yeah, definitely.
I really, really enjoyed it. So it's highly recommended. Do recommend for you guys to watch. It is on Netflix at the moment, so check it out, guys.
And in case you're wondering what it's actually about, Enola is actually Sherlock and Mycroft's much, much younger sister, who has had no relationship with them whatsoever. No. She's only really been with her mother right up until she's 16, and then her mother disappears.
Yes.
And her brothers are relatively useless at trying to find her mother, so she sets off on an adventure to find her herself.
Yeah. And it's actually very sweet. It's very nicely done. I like the character of Enola. She's interesting, she's intriguing. Millie Bobby Brown does an excellent job portraying her.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. So highly recommended to you guys. Anyone who's a very faithful sort of Sherlock Holmes reader might get a little bit annoyed by how some of the characters are portrayed, but honestly, if you're willing to watch things like Elementary and Sherlock and, you know, even the Robert Downey Jr. one, you can probably stomach this one. I think a few people have sort of said, oh, but that's not what Mycroft is like, and I'm like, it doesn't really matter, does it? That's not really what Sherlock is like either, but we'll take what we can get, won't we?
Definitely.
So yeah, definitely worth watching. And on that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do get in touch with us. Let us know what your favourite ghost stories are, or whether you have any ghost stories you'd like to share with us. Some spooky happenings in the run-up to Halloween, we'd love to hear them. Remember, you can get in touch with us on Tumblr, or on Facebook, or on Twitter. And that you can get in touch with us both individually or via Dissecting Dragons. Hoping everyone's keeping well, and we'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.